Sunday Show with Ireland's Blue Book, a romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome to the Sunday Show. And I have a very special guest this evening, Jerry Creighton. Jerry, now you have spent most of your life working at Dublin Zoo. People will know you very well. You're famous on TV. You travel around the world now with your new company, Global Elephant Care. And now, you congratulations.
Indeed, it's with my book out, it's been quite a journey. Now, I must say, it's been an incredible journey. You know, obviously, you know, as I mentioned throughout the book, you know, my story began as a very young boy with my father, Jerry Creighton Sr., who was the operations, or the senior curator at Dublin Zoo. And as a kid, like, you know, I'd go up to the zoo with my father. Yeah, you know, we lived close by. We lived in Stony Batter, which is a very trendy part of Dublin now to live.
Yeah, well, I'm in Cabra, Jerry.
That's where I am now. I'm proud of it. But, you know, a great opportunity as a young kid to be around my dad, you know, learning, you know, the trials and tribulations of zoo life. So it was probably the longest apprenticeship ever, because I started at 5 or 6. Started at 15 then as a trainee keeper, working with the big cats again with my father and the elephants. And so, you know, it's to where I am today, to having a global elephant care consultancy business is amazing. I always wanted to make a difference. I always wanted to be the voice of the elephants. Elephants, you know, have been treated very badly in human care for many reasons. Architect design, taken away as neonatals, as young animals. So it's time to give something back. And I'm now in a position with the accumulated knowledge that I've gathered over the last 37 years of being a zookeeper to operations manager of Dublin Zoo, which is a zoo I'm very proud of and very proud of to still have a strong association with, to now having a company that is helping elephants globally.
Yeah, I must say, right, I'm going to get it. I managed to get a good read of the book, right,
great,
in the last few days.
Brilliant.
I must say it's a page turner. But before we get into that, I mean, the zoo over the years, the concept of zoos, I suppose, and, you know, like these aqua parks and, yeah, you know, the things we've seen. Now, I mean, some people, you know, would say, oh, you know, that zoos, I suppose, are, you know, that, oh, they're cruel to animals and that. But I mean, it very much depends, Jerry, doesn't it, on the zoo and where. Like, it could be, if it's in Eastern Europe, it could be an awful place. But if it's here, it could be state of the art.
Yeah, it is, and it's a very, very valid question. And people, and you know, it's, for me, it's encouraging and almost inspiring that people are asking these questions now, because for many years, like, you know, even when I was a young kid in the 70s and, you know, or the 80s in the zoo, people came to the zoo and it was entertainment, nothing more. You know, and I remember as a young keeper, like every Monday morning in the chimps pit, going in with a broom and a shovel and brush and taking out bags and bags of peanut shells. They used to sell them outside the zoo. But it was entertainment for people, and I totally get that. And, you know, and people still have that memory of the zoo. And I understand that, you know, oh, like zoos are bad, and or they don't do the animals' biology or psychology right. But it's changed, and we have to embrace the change. The change has been so, so significant. And, you know, as an advocate for animal wellness globally, I mean, I couldn't possibly sit here and tell you in one breath that I love elephants and I love animals and say, but I'm happy for them being in zoos. The evolution, the transformation of zoos has been so significant. And Dublin Zoo is one I can obviously, you know, put my hand on my heart, say has changed. I mean, from the 80s, Dublin Zoo was the fourth oldest zoo in the world. And up until the 80s, we had all these wide range of structural and husbandry problems, things that were designed, houses that were designed for confinement, for containment, by architects that do nothing about the animal's psychology, their biology, their needs, their social groupings. But that has changed to a point. And remember, like, you know, we're going to talk for hopefully for an hour, I think, right? In that time, 5 African elephants will be killed.
Now, I mean, that is...
That's the reality, but we got to...
I know, and I mean, Gorillas in the Mist, and I know the terrible statistics, but and I was saying to you when we met earlier there, I lived in South Africa for seven years and fell in love with safaris and animals, you know, out in the wild. But like you said, that is such a scary thing, and it's sometimes hard to impress it upon people.
It is indeed, that's where we have to get back to, just to go back to your question about zoos and the rights of people. Oh yeah, of the rights of people, the anachronistic view of zoos and being, it's an old perception. Like zoos, and particularly zoos like Dublin Zoo, there's an organisation called EASA, which is the European Association of Zoos and Aquariums, that involves, 400 or 500 zoos. They work together. Every year they meet collectively for strategies to identify species that need care and help. And even for breeding loans, like people don't understand the complexity. For example, in Dublin Zoo, we have Asiatic lion. You know, we've very rare primates. And it's not a matter that they're all put together. It's a bit like Tinder for tigers, to be quite honest. But there's a stud book keeper that recognises which genetic animals should go together for genetic reasons, for biodiversity, to keep this, you know, this species sustainable. But like the zoos that I work with, And the way my message is now, you know, to create these dynamic habitats where the animals' design, how they live, their biology, their psychology, their physiology is taken into the design concept. So people have to forget about the old images of zoo. Be open-minded, embrace what zoos are doing. They're educational, of course, they're conservation, but all the good zoos of this world today are making a massive contribution to the conservation of animals. I'm working in Howlett's Wild Animal Park in the UK. It's in Kent, near Canterbury. And we're on the verge of sending back 13 African elephants to the wild, back to Shimba Hills in Kenya. A world first, a very world first, that elephants will go back. Now, they won't be just dropped into the wild. They'll go into a reserve. They'll go into an area where they'll be managed. They'll have to habituate. They'll have to become desensitized to climate, to food, but this is what zoos are doing. But, you know, and Dublin Zoo, again, which I referred to, which is a zoo obviously I'm very passionate about, now has a 10-year conservation plan to help conservation here in Ireland, newts, you know, wild birds, birds of prey, insects, biodiversity. Like the modern zoo now is a conservation organisation that runs a zoo. And, you know, so people have to get away to the idea of animals walk back and forth. Like, for an example, another zoo I'm working with at the moment is Al Ain Zoo. Now, Al Ain Zoo, it's in the UAE, in the Middle East. They took in elephants from Namibia.
I loved the Tatasha Park.
Fabulous place. Mm. Human-elephant conflict. Now, it's questionable, okay, these elephants left the wild to come to a zoo, a safari-type place. But I'm there. We've developed a 20-hectare site, which is huge. And what it all involves is motivation for the elephants, where they have choice, control, autonomy over their old day. I go out in the morning with the team. We bring in JCBs. We create hills where they weren't there before. Topography, landscapes, massive changes. So the elephant comes out in the morning and says, where do I go now? Do I go left? Do I go right? Do I go over the hill? Where do I find the resources? So we understand the biology a lot more. And I have to say this. Let me say this, as a passionate advocate for zoos. I would love to be able to say to you now, and I hope one day we never need zoos. Yeah. I really hope that. I genuinely hope that. But it's not going to be the case. Even in Africa, the parks are managed. Everywhere in the world. I was in the Kaziranga National Park, where I'd seen the wild elephants and the conservation we were doing with Dublin Zoo. And we had to stop the traffic to allow the elephants to go to feed. So these are the problems. So please, be kind and be judgmental. Do your research before you condemn zoos, because there is nothing left of the wild. But we can make a difference. We can change and we can help it. But as a whole, biodiversity, the whole world needs to be looked at, and we need help.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's something that's great to hear what you're saying there, because, I mean, the routes that elephants used to take, I mean, you know, I was reading your book there and about, you know, I mean, when I remember being in Africa as well and experiencing them firsthand, they have this majestic intelligence about them, and you'd know this now better than I would. And the routes that they would have taken, you know, and then we come along and we just build all over the place and we kind of screw up their whole way of life, and they adapt. And I mean, but you know, they can't just keep adapting forever. That's why I think your point is so good.
They can't keep adapting. There was a programme on recently, and it was called An Apology to the Elephants. Well, there's a picture of an elephant in a circus on top of a little platform and a chain to its leg. Like the injustice that we have done these elephants over historically cannot be even measured. Mm-hmm. You know, we took them away as neonatals. We ride elephants. We use them in circuses. I've worked with these animals. When you see an elephant in a circus or you go to Thailand and you want to ride on the back of an elephant, that's a broken spirit. You have something that looks like an elephant. Yeah, it's grey, it has a trunk, great. But apart from that, they have the von Econome, the spindle neurons in the brain. I've seen them firsthand. They celebrate life coming into the herd. As a new baby drops to the sand floor, it's a dynamic experience. I've there and I've cried and I've watched it. And all the young females are brought around to the sights, the smells, the unique moment as that baby is welcomed into the herd, securing the future of it. There's so much sentiment, their passion, their love for caring for one another. We could actually learn from them. It's all about the investment in the next family, the next generation of the family. I mean, they go back to bones of an elephant that has died in the herd a year later, and they touch the bones and they almost like awake again. And they say, you know, they're there and together. So, I mean, they're just incredibly unique. And I've been lucky to be there and see these young elephants born, fall to the floor. The young males are pushed away. They got nothing to offer. Go away, you guys. You have nothing to offer. The young females are brought in. It's all about the investment in the herd. And that's what I preach now as I go around the world in terms of elephants. And I say, you know, they have to be in human care. I hope it won't happen forever, but that's not probably highly unlikely. But I encourage autonomy, choice, control for the elephant, where they have, you know, their own life to live, their own decisions. And these are kind of the topics that, you know, I cover in the book. It was just to send that solid message that, you know, we can make a difference and we can help our natural world.
Yeah, and it seems to be as well, Gerry, like in certain countries where there's a lot of poverty. I remember, like, you know, talking to rangers in South Africa down in Karika and places, and they were saying, like, there'd never be a thing like ride an elephant down there. Like, it just wouldn't exist. But yet in other countries, like in Asia,
yeah.
And what you're talking about now, kind of heartbreaking stuff, the way they're just literally kind of captive, they're made captive, and then they're like slaves.
Well, they're taken away as neonatals, as babies from the mother. They break the spirit using violence. Now, I worked free contact. Just to explain this, there's a couple of methods of managing elephants in human care. One is free contact. Free contact means you share the same space with the elephant. But the elephant, from the time it's a neonatal, understands the consequence of not conforming to your rules. If you have a hook in your hand with sharp points on it, so if the elephant doesn't conform, you stick it into the back of his ear or behind his leg. Now, I managed elephants in this system, but the two old elephants that I had always done what you wanted, Judy and Kirsty in Dublin Zoo, because they knew the consequences. Like, people would say, but you never had to do that. I know, well, it's because they knew from previous generations that if they didn't conform. Now, no animal in any zoo or in any human care situation should live under the threat of violence. And there is still elephants living under that system. Like, when you go to Thailand and it's wonderful, you go down to the river and their elephants are blowing water on you or you're riding on their back. These are suppressed elephants that have been controlled and dominated by humans. This is the reality. Elephants don't want to stand there and blow water on you like a snorkel. It's wrong. And most of them, elephants are chained, by their leg under the water, you know, so you don't see it. But the consequences, and then they kind of got tourist friendly. The mahouts, as they call it, who dominates the elephant, stopped bringing the hook. But they have 10-inch sharpened nails that you don't see, and they'll stick the elephant to conform. An elephant's back, its whole physiology, is pointed, curved spines. You sitting on that elephant is going to cause pain and suffering. I mean, by all accounts, there's many places in these countries where you can do positive encounters, you know, with rescued elephants.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But please, for the sake of the elephant, do your homework, you know, or else they're trying to get the dollar out of you. Do your homework, and for the sake of the elephant, care. And I mentioned this on many occasions in the book. There's one particular elephant in the book that I talk about, you know, and she's an elephant that came from, you know, circuses and zoos in Mexico. And I mentioned in the book where she tried to push a keeper over because she was rebelling to the dominance that had been inflicted on her from a baby. Anyway, she was beaten with baseball bats into submission. And then she was in a zoo in Mexico where that flooded, and she tried to survive by holding onto a trunk for 3 days. Thankfully she did. But read her story, like, in the book, where I've been working with a team there, and it's in the Tennessee Sanctuary in, you know, in Nashville. It's incredible. But, you know, these are the things that motivate me. you know, motivate me. And I'm so proud of the zoo I work in. I worked in Dublin Zoo, and I'm so proud of what I'm trying to do around the world now.
Jerry, staggering statistic. What would you say, about 40,000 Asian elephants only left in the wild now?
That's correct. The Asian or the Indian elephant, you know, which is... the problem is India, you know. I don't mean that problem is India, but it's a human-dominated landscape. You know, India is going to surpass China as the most populous country in the world. Every day, like, you know, they're getting killed on railroad tracks, electric fence into people to protect their product, their paddy fields. And I understand people have to protect it, but the Asian elephant is down to less than 40,000, you know, individuals. And they're in fragmented populations. I was very lucky to go to the Kaziranga National Park in India as part of my job with Dublin Zoo to look at the conservation work that we were doing out there at the time. And it was heartbreaking to see the elephants. We had to stop the traffic on the road to allow the elephants to migrate across a roadway that they had travelled for thousands of years. Like, just think about that. You know, their families genetically. And then, you know, India is a country that I greatly admire. But culturally, you know, as a culture, like, they love Ganesh, which is the god, the elephant god. And yet, like, you know, it's a very contradictory country because... culture has been destroyed by commerce in India. And what you have, and you have these massive big bull elephants, ceremonial bulls, beautiful white tusks, all done out in almost like, you know, costume sets for these religious festivals. And they get 10,000 like rupees or more, or £10,000 a day. So, you know, it's all under the name of religion and tradition, but it's actually a commercial venture. And the amount of elephants that are standing in temples in India, you know, for hours and hours. Now, remember, an elephant is biologically designed to move for 18 hours a day for food and for searching. And they have them in temples in costume. And then people get killed because the elephant goes mad. And yeah. Why wouldn't it happen?
I mean, it's fascinating. We were chatting earlier today about Namibia. I mean, when I remember spending a few months in Namibia with the Himba tribe, and I had I was like, it was digital detox completely. But I mean, they would, during drought, I mean, they would know where water was, and they would travel, as you said, miles and miles and miles. And just like the sheer sort of ingrained intelligence that is in them, generation handed down to generation.
That's it. You know, the complex society led by the matriarch. I'm lucky enough to be working again, as I say, in the UAE, Al Ain Zoo. And Al Ain Zoo took in 9 elephants from Namibia that were sold at an auction by the government because of human elephant conflict. They were either going to be destroyed or moved off somewhere else. But anyway, Al Ain Zoo took them in, but they needed support, and they brought me in. And I'm now like working with these magnificent elephants. I train them I train them under, you know, proper terms, kindness, positive reinforcement to present their feet for pedicures. People don't understand that elephants need a lot of care. So it's almost like the Hilton Hotel for elephants out there. They get pedicures, they get power washes, they get, you know, trained for blood draws. But, you know, the complexity of these environments where they come from, like, they were just the human elephant conflict situation was too great. So I had to mention that in the book. But thankfully I'm out there making a huge difference, and we're going to go back and do conservation with the zoo to build villages, to build schools, to do internships, to bring the people out there and back to UAE to educate them. So this is what, again, goes back to what good zoos are doing. You know, working with communities, working with the statistics to make sure that both humans and elephants can cohabitate and live together successfully.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's amazing work what you're doing. And I mean, what I love about, I mean, I love Raised by Wolves is a great title for a book. I love the title, your book, Raised by the Zoo, right?
Yeah,
which is brilliant.
Oh.
And I love it. It's a very funny read as well. You've great humour in the book, right? And when you talk about, like, you go around and you chat to different places and you talk to schools. But when you went to Mount Joy, Jerry, tell us, I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, like, it was great because honestly, I mean, I went to Brunner. You know, a lot of people from Dublin have the Brunner School in the inner city. Originally, was from Iver Street, which is just, you know, Manor Place, as I mentioned earlier. And so I got a call up at the zoo. Listen, you know, the prisoners are down there. Animals are a great way of communicating. Would you be interested in coming down to talk to them? I said, listen, I'd go anywhere. And that's what I love about my job. I could be talking to government officials someday. I could be talking to presidents. I could be talking to a small creche group. I still have the same passion for talking about elephants and animals. Anyway, went down to Mountjoy. So called into a room first. He said, now listen, Jerry, these fellas are going to be a bit hard on you. They might might try to take the pity. They might try to make it funny and all that. But listen, just take, we have people there to watch you. Everything will be fine. You know, just answer whatever you can do. I said, yeah, grand, no bother. No bother. So, of course, I went into this like classroom, like setting 40, 50 blokes. And, how are you, Jerry Creighton? How are you, Kevin? And they all came running up and they're slapping me fingers and they're, there you go, high fiving me. All right,
it's Pat. The elephant man.
And it was great. So I knew all these fellas from school. And of course, the guys that were working there would say, Jerry, you know them all. I said, yeah. And I said, listen, it was about different opportunities. I was lucky enough to have the zoo and my dad and to be able to go there. They didn't get the opportunity. There was no different. But we great. I ended up spending 5 or 6 hours there, going around all the cells. They were showing me the artwork. You know, and that's what it's about. Like, the book is, it's got some very sad situations, but it's got a lot of humour. Like, I love Dublin Whitman. I love Dublin people. And, you know, you'd be talking, I remember talking to a gang of Whitman outside of shit. They were real, it was an inner city project. They came up to the zoo. It was hilarious. And I was talking to them about the chimpanzees, and I was outside the chimp habitat. And they were looking at me and they said, listen about them. How do you stop them breeding, or did they just keep breeding? I said, listen, the way this is a true story, by the way, as well. I said, with chimpanzees, I says, they're very like women, I said, you know, and men, the way in their whole biology, they're our closest relative, I says. So we said, see that female there now? We don't want her to breed anymore, so we have her on the pill. Anyway, you have her on the pill? Why would you have her on the pill? Well, I said, it's an awful lot of reason trying to put a condom on that male over there. And of course, you know, great old Dublin stories. And, you know, so I love that part of it. You know, I'm a Dub true and true myself. And it's just great to be in a situation to see the progress of the zoo and to see where we are. And you know, it's got, like, I'm out in the desert last week in UAE, and I said, who would have ever thought, I'm out here in 53 degrees, a red-headed, you know, Irish man from the inner city of Dublin, showing the world, you know, and people how elephants can be taken care of. But, it's a very proud moment.
Well, I mean, I was only in Cleveland a few weeks ago, Jerry, and amazing, for such a small country, we seem to punch above our weight everywhere we go.
Well, exactly. I've been over to America, like, you know, later on this year, actually next month, 4 elephants from Dublin Zoo will go to Cincinnati Zoo. And I said, wow. I 5 years ago, I went over to Cincinnati. They brought me over to talk to their staff, to the people. They get a massive donor support there, the people that donate to the zoo. So I said, you know, if you get this guys, you guys get it right, we can help you. And now that the Dublin Zoo herd has been so successful, a micro family is going to go over there that will set off a whole new wave of positivity on elephants in North America, because it's a multi-generational herd, a related herd. Elephants have to be together, you know, and that's great just to see that the influence that we've had, you know. But it wasn't always that way. As I said, I mentioned in the book, you know, I've been very lucky to see the evolutionary stages of Dublin Zoo through my career. And the 80s were horrible. They were very poor. The zoo was poor. We were going around asking for a euro or a punt at the time to stay open. It was that sad. And I remember Charlie Hottie was the Prime Minister. Mick Doyle, who was, people remember him, he was a rugby coach for Ireland, but he was a vet too. And Charlie Hottie said, go in and either fix that place or close it down, because, you know, we're getting too much bad press. Mick Doyle came in and we all had a staff meeting, and I was only a young keeper at the time, but he said that we've spoken to the people of Dublin and Ireland, they want the zoo. So lucky enough then, there was money was getting put back in to rejuvenate the zoo. Then it moved on to Bertie Ahern was the Taoiseach. And Bertie, with the zoo, was in his constituency. He was Minister for Finance. We got the right funding. We got more land of Orisanukdaron. We got a director then. Peter Wilson was the director that actually saved the zoo, because he'd done all the negotiations with the government. But then we got Leo Oosterweegel, who was a Dutchman. He was director at Melbourne Zoo. Very, very definite vision on the way the zoo should go. Created something special, working with the team, and brought the zoo up to international standards. And I remember a time where you'd be nearly hiding in your uniform from Dublin Zoo. You were embarrassed. The polar bears, the conditions were awful. To now where you were literally, you couldn't wait to go out in your uniform at night. You'd need to go into a nightclub with, oh, you're from the zoo.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it's been, like, the transformation is amazing. I mean, absolutely incredible. And I mean, in no small part as well, let's just chat a little bit about, I mean, your TV show, I mean, was phenomenal. And I mean, you know, that was, I think as well, for people, any programs about animals are always very, very enticing and very, you know, entertaining. But the your personality, the way that was filmed and done, how did that come about, Jerry? Because it was really
the same thing. Shane Brennan from Moondance Productions had approached the zoo, it must be 13, 14 years ago now. Went to Leo again. Leo, it was a great decision by Leo Oosterweegel, the director, and he said, can I film a show? And they said, no, we're not ready for you. But Leo had his vision, got all the habitats right for the animals. where it would look well, both behind the scenes and front of house. You know, we had the conditions that were up to international standards. But I never forget like talking to Leo in his office and saying to him, this is going to be a great success. He said, hey, Jerry, a Dutchman. He was really cool, calm, collected man. Hey, Jerry, it's going to be honest. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, we're going to say everything. Because people often ask me, like, what's the mortality rate in the zoo? Well, I said, it's 100%. Everything dies at some point. But it's how we manage it, how we look after it. So Leo, like, was there and he said, no, it's not going to be all about cuddly little baby animals. It's about real zoo life. Life, death, animals being transferred, crazy situations that can happen, but all natural situations. And I remember there's a species of monkey called a macaque, and the macaque lost her baby. She died at birth, but she carried the baby around for 3 days, which they do until she actually knows that this baby's dead and she can't offer any more hope or life.
Yeah.
Sheila the lioness that we looked after for 23-24 years, me and my father actually, and then Sheila got to a point where her condition was so bad that we got together, not so bad in terms of she was suffering, but we said, listen, she can't function properly, her body's breaking down, now is the right time to make a decision with our vet team, our keepers, and we said, she needs to go to sleep. Sheila, at 23 years old, which is a remarkable age for a lioness, we put her to sleep live on camera. She took her last breath in front of the people of this country.
That was very hard to watch.
It was very hard to watch. But the very next day, people rang and said, how are the keepers? Now we understand what a zoo life. So that's what the show done.
Yeah.
Now I get stopped to this day, which is wonderful. Like even I'll be out with my wife, Leo, and my kids. Ah, Dad, you're not getting sick of this. No, 30, 40 seconds of people saying, how is the zoo? I love what you do there. That's all it ever takes. And I love that. Mm-hmm. I have that energy to give something. And the whole honesty, people were saying, Jesus, that show was like an emotional roller coaster, right? We're sitting in with the kids every Friday and we don't know whether to be laughing or crying. But that was the reality of zoo life.
Yeah.
And for me, it changed the whole perception of people coming to the zoo. Because I remember as a kid, people coming in, as I said, the bag of nuts at the front gate, bags of apples, sweets. I remember never forget it as a kid, a fella flicking a cigarette into the orangutans. The orangutan would mimic people and smoke it, but it was born in the hair and its skin.
Because they're one of the most intelligent.
Very intelligent.
Aren't they? Yeah.
And people thought this was funny. But then what the show did was that people came in, they respected the zoo. It's a kind place. And again, like it was part of the psychology, we'd say people, the animals are first, you're second. This is their home. It's not a circus. Be patient. When you walk by a habitat, if the animal is not there, come back and respect them. And it's been an amazing transformation. And now the people are so proud of the zoo. And the people that say to me, oh, man, I see on your home, on your, on the TV program, what you're doing with your home. Like, I meet chimpanzees, lions and tigers, leopards, jaguars living in the house. Like, the dedication it takes.
Dr. Doolittle.
Crazy. Like, you know, as I said, Lucy, one of the chimpanzees, lived with us for 2 years. As I said, she had a cot at the end of the bed.
Living with Lucy.
Living with Lucy. She had a cot at the end of the bed, me and the Mrs. Leona. She'd jump in the bed between the two. It was the best contraceptive we ever had. She couldn't even touch one another. Lucy gets jealous of who was. But great stories. Like, and that's why it's all depicted in the book.
My house would be burned to the ground if I did that.
No, it's amazing stories of a very, very privileged life, a very privileged situation to be in. You know, and like animals, you know, for me are uncomplicated. You know, as I always say, like you could go into the zoo and you could go to, like, say, for Saibu, an orangutan that I had a great relationship. And I don't mean, you could go into Saibu in an Armani suit or a Penny's pair of shorts or even in your nude and you still get the same reaction. They don't judge you by what you're wearing. It's you. It's your attitude.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what we can learn from animals, to be uncomplicated, to respect one another, to care for another, and only do things when you have a reason that's either to help one another, to defend one another, or to provide for one another.
Jerry, you know, you're bringing me back to really happy memories of Daktari, Born Free, you know, great programmes on telly. It's amazing how that world then, you know, it seemed like a million miles away, you know, Kenya and those places. And now, I mean, listening to you there, it's just like literally a few hours and you're on a plane and you're everywhere. And the world has completely changed, hasn't it? In terms of animal welfare, I suppose that can be good and bad, can't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the world is so accessible now. It's funny, like, you know, as you say, like Tarzan and the movie. And I was engrossed in them, but I was privileged to be, I thought was the Tarzan of Dublin at 5 or 6 years old, where you could go up to the zoo. You didn't realise you were in a space of 30 acres, and my dad say, off you go for a walk. And but all the keepers were great. They look after each other's kids. But I used to think I was Tarzan running around and seeing all the animals. But yeah, what you're saying is correct. Like the communication is great, being able to travel short distances. But there's huge consequences, like, as well, like, even in Africa, where ecotourism is critical to the survival of a lot of economies. But, like, for example, the African hunting dog now is suffering from parvovirus, which is brought in by domestic dogs on people visiting. The mountain gorillas, you know, in Rwanda are suffering from colds and flu and COVID.
And of course, I mean, I know avian bird flu is, yeah. I mean, the Chinese, massive as well.
Yeah, it's kind of one of these delicate situations that we have to try and manage. But, you know, I'm reluctantly optimistic for the future, but it really is down to the work that zoos. Zoos definitely, I mean, as we've mentioned earlier on in the programme, they needed to change, they needed to rebrand in terms of what they were doing, what they were, shows, they were entertainment. But I hope that the message comes out of our conversation tonight is that people look at zoos and what they're doing. Like Dublin Zoo, like 90 is going to attain 90% of its species are endangered species in the next 10 years. They have a dynamic 10-year program for conservation, both at home and in the wild. You know, and like I'm working with Allion Zoo again, another one that I mentioned. And what we're going to go back to Namibia, create internships, scholarships from the villages, build villages for the people that are in human elephant conflict. We're actually going to encourage the children and show them how to make arts and crafts to sell in the zoo shop in Allion, so they have revenue that if their elephant comes in and eats their other sources of revenue. So what I'm trying to get to, I guess, in a nutshell, is the global impact of zoos cannot be underestimated. And the IUCN, which is the International Union for Conservation, only came out the other day and made a statement and says that zoos have been paramount to the success and the survival of many, many species and will be going forward. Now, accredited zoos, I will emphasise that. Mm. There is a lot of zoos, particularly in, as you mentioned earlier on, Eastern Europe, roadside zoos in the US, which are now being phased out. But like Dublin Zoo sets up to international standards as in part of a designated body of zoo professionals that are determined and adamant that they're going to create the best conditions for the animals that we need.
Well, what you're saying, I mean, it's almost like it's a no-brainer, because when you look at David Attenborough's recent programmes, right, when he talked about the planet and the different ones, and when you hear him talking about the growth, and when you look, you know, 1983, we had X number, then billion, and you see the exponential growth, Jerry, in us as a species. I mean, it wouldn't give you great hope. And I mean, we are trying to be hopeful, I suppose. But when you see the growth of population, there's only so much space. So I think, you know, we nearly want to be designating islands and sort of like, yeah. You know, don't you think?
Well, you see, this is what I try to mention, that, you know, if you look geographically at matches, at the map, I should say, and you look at Africa and Asia, you can see all these animals are being pushed into smaller pockets. And eventually them smaller pockets will be zoos. But the only thing is, the modern zoo is becoming very proactive, and I think over the next 20 years you'll see a huge evolution. In other words, zoos like Dublin, London, Chester, the key zoos of the world, and the San Diego's and the Singapore zoos will be looking after and allocating projects in these home range countries, where they're actually, your whole part of your job is minding the communities, protecting, you know, landscapes, protecting thousands of acres. You know, in that sense, that, you know, but the climate changes, you know, is going to be the biggest problem. We've seen our poor, you know, countrymen and women in Cork the other day, like being flooded, and these weird things.
Yeah,
that are.
But, I mean, you can see that everywhere. The world, the weather has gone crazy. Yeah. It's gone, like, you know, everything. I mean, the leaves are on the trees still in November.
You have polar bears now walking down streets.
That's a really sad one, isn't it? I mean, I was looking at that the other day again. I mean, the ice cap and green and those. But I mean, that's going to be, that's such a scary thing.
It's such an impact. You know, these nomadic animals that, you know, generally swim and move for miles and miles, are living on these smaller little patches of land, and like the consequences are so great. I don't know. I mean, you, you still try to be optimistic and you try to make people aware at home. And I think it does really start at home. Like, we have to be aware of what's going on. Like, the amount of stuff that we use in like, for example, in palm oil. Biscuits, chocolates, shampoos, and it's still happening on
and the plastic.
Please, Jerry, just read it and make sure it's palm oil free. Like Chester is a palm oil free city. But when you're supporting that, and that means the orangutans will have no trees to climb on. You know, the plastics, plant a tree. Please recycle. Like, let's try. I know it seems I won't make a difference, but you actually will. You know, and it's amazing that the one thing that does inspire me is everywhere I go is that the next generation of children. When I was, you know, a young keeper in the zoo, what do they eat, Mister? Is all you got. Now the kids are saying, "Tell us about this species. We know what's happening in their native. You know, we know there's elephants being killed. We know that there's, you know, animals being butchered for the meat trade. We know all these problems, and which is great. So you just have to. And even I've been to China only recently, and you know, China as a culture, you know, where animals are used as a resource, even that's changing. Now it might be slow, but everywhere you go in China, it's telling you about the ivory trade, like the rhino horn, keratin, the same substance as the human nail. You know, killing a rhino for an aphrodisiac or cancer, it's just so we have to be educated. The thing is, it's still happening. You know, it is still happening. I'll be out there. I'll be still battling hard for the elephants. I'll still be battling hard. And, you know, as I say, my accumulated knowledge, I didn't know any degrees. I didn't know any kind of... It's a knowledge and a passion that has brought me all over the world, working at the biggest zoos in the world, being a voice for the elephants. And I'll continue to do all I can to protect elephants and the environment they live in.
I mean, the statistics are very interesting. I mean, just in terms of Dublin, where we're talking about tonight, I suppose, 1 million visitors a year through the zoo. I mean, and I know COVID was a terrible time for us all, a bit of a blip there, but the phenomenal, really, isn't it? Like, I mean, and I think it's great. Mm. I mean, I know you go and you talk to schools, and, you know, education is a great thing, but that is lovely. I mean, I was in Prague Zoo, would you believe? Yeah. And actually, you've probably been there. You've probably been to every zoo in the world.
Not quite, but I will be.
And it's a lovely city as well, Jerry. Mm. But I'm very impressed with it, you know, whereas I won't mention one or two other Eastern European countries where I was like, I left a few years ago and I was like, oh God, you know, I was in tears almost.
I know, and I
you
still see
the dirty water and you see, you know, but and then, as you said, you go and you travel and you see, I mean, like safaris, which you think a safari now is all out in nature, but of course they're all, you know,
still managed
as you'd say. So there is, but I mean, I suppose to be nice, to try and give it's hard sometimes to give a hopeful message, but from what you're saying, I think the future is going to be very much about managing this, isn't it?
It's very much about management. It's about cooperation with governments. A lot of governments are becoming aware, like if there's very productive work being done in the Brazilian rainforest, there's reductions in deforestation there. You know, Africa is a very complicated continent because of the politics. There's still an incredible amount of bribery that goes on there. Every level of the government. Africa, we have to seize the chance to work with the communities there. But if you work with the people on the ground and give them the resources, like selling arts and crafts in your zoo shop, like creating little schools, and we will have hope. But it's a difficult road ahead. The underestimation of zoos, please don't do that, because they're very significant. They're very, very important. You know, there's people like myself that will go out there and advocate and create optimal conditions for animals, like, you know, the things that we're doing. And where I go, it's about giving the animal choice, opportunity, control, autonomy, decision-making process. We are getting there, but, you know, the world, make no doubt about it, is in a troubled state. But we have to have hope. And the only thing that hope is that, you know, when I see how we transferred the community in Ireland, and from people thinking it was just a casual day out at the zoo, to people that are caring, to people that are stopping me on the street saying, "Hey, Jerry, we love what you do. We love what the zoo does. We love the work. We love and our aware of concept." It gives me hope. But we can't let up. We can't let up, because, you know, it's crazy. Like in India, there's elephants there now that are bull elephants, I mean, that have no tusks. They're called muknas, and it's a defence mechanism, because all the main bull elephants with big tusks have been shot out for ivory or been taken away from ceremonials. So now they're coping by producing tuskless males.
Wow.
Now, the good thing is they won't be shot. But nature is adapting to a situation where, how awful though not to see a magnificent 6-ton bull standing proud, looking over his horizon, going off to integrate with a herd of females to mate and protect his species. But now they don't have tusks anymore. They're trying to cope. It's very, very sad. You know, it's awful. But, you know, I'm still very optimistic. You know, I'll keep banging the drum. I'll keep doing my best.
Yeah, well, I must say, I mean, like, what's fascinating, I think, you know, people's minds have changed an awful lot. And, I mean, you're championing the animal, Gerry. And, I mean, I think now, from what you're saying tonight and having chatted to you, zoos are, it's essential. Because I think without that, it's, I mean, the animals are just out there, you know, and without protection, really, to a certain extent, from what you, when you, you know, when you look at what you're actually
absolutely
saying.
Absolutely. There is certain areas, of course, where they do have protection. But ultimately, everybody has to go home at night. It's very hard to keep a constant situation on them. And you know, there is some very, very hopeful studies, and so like the golden line salmon oryx reintroduction from zoos have been very good. They're getting better as we go on, but there's a lot of political instability. But zoos will be key, absolutely key, to the education, the conservation, and making sure that we have animals for the future. And I will say it, you know, as I say, obviously I don't work at Dublin Zoo anymore, but it's a zoo that I'm deeply associated with and hope to be for the rest of my life. Support it, care for it, go up there and look at the habitats that have been created, look at its vision for the future. And we're very lucky to be in a small city, you know, in Europe, but to have one of the best zoos in the world.
Yeah, and you know, there's other lovely little green, there's green shoots. I mean, I had a great time up in Wild Ireland, a friend of yours, Killian McLaughlin, that you know, and to see bears, and yeah, you know, he has loads of animals, and he's doing great work as
a
well.
Wonderful work. Killian is a long time friend. I've been up with Killian for the last couple of years, consulting and helping and advising. His vision, the landscape up there is so good, you know, for the species, yeah, the wolf, the lynx.
I mean, 10 minutes from Derry City,
yeah,
right? 15 minutes, and you're in this wild
it's
Ireland.
Gorgeous. And we've been, yeah, up there working and planning together. He's got a great ambitions. He's a true conservationist. It's my pleasure to help him. We're good friends. He's on the phone to me literally every day asking advice and help, like to be bringing these iconic species back to Ireland, and to represent them in really authentic habitats is remarkable. And I wish him every success, because he's doing a really, really good job there.
No, well, I'll tell you, people like Killian and yourself, you know, I mean, you're the animal's friend. If elephants could talk, Gerry, I'd say you'd be getting the Elephant Nobel Peace Prize at this stage.
Oh, no, we'll keep
and
going.
Amazing work, and it's been such a pleasure to talk to you tonight. The book, Raised by the Zoo, is a great read, and I will say I really enjoyed it. And so good to learn so much from it, and to be chatting to yourself tonight. So, Gerry, good luck with your everything, and Global Elephant Care, good luck with everything for the future. And thanks a million for talking to us on the Sunday Show this evening.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.